Clicker go.
And that's it. Go.
Okay. I don't think there is much point in being too formal about this, even though this talk was described as being a formal colloquium. I encourage and invite everyone to just chime in and debate as they please. So I'm just going to go list some of the issues here, which I consider worthy of theoretical attention. Most of these, 2 through 7, I would consider observations of the Kuiper Belt requiring better theory. The first one I would call good theory deserving better observations. Okay, so I won't describe these in detail now. It'll just become obvious as I go through this talk. So I showed this next plot only to try to convince you that as theorists we should pay attention to the Kuiper Belt, because it's a field in which the data are just coming at us at a very rapid rate. So here is our state of knowledge of the outer solar system as of the turn of the 20th century. Here's the Sun, here's Neptune, here in nearly circular orbit at 30 AU distance from the Sun. 1929, Claude Tombaug blinked his way to finding Pluto here in a fairly eccentric orbit in a 3-to-2 mean motion resonance with Neptune. And it wasn't until 1992 that, after years of dedicated searching, David Jewett and Jane Liu discovered 92QB1, otherwise known to those in the know as Smiley, here on its nearly circular orbit, a distance of some 43 AU. And in the 10 or 11 years that have elapsed since the discovery of QB1, there's been an explosion of data. And despite this plot, I have to say, being more than 2 years out of date, my attempt at plotting all of their orbits still saturates my screen and I lose information. So I've coded the objects according to a very rough scheme. I'll describe a better one shortly. Here, these green orbits correspond to classical belt objects like that of 92QB1, so nearly circular, but sometimes often inclined orbits. There's the Plutinos. Every one of these yellow orbits inhabits the 3-to-2 mean motion resonance with Neptune. And finally, these purple trajectories correspond to the scattered belt. And in many cases, you can see they're just literally off scale, highly eccentric, highly inclined objects. Okay, so there's something like 700, I would say, approaching 1,000 objects that have been discovered. But of these, I would say something like 200 to 300 actually have decent orbits. Okay, and I'm part of a collaboration to find these things. So every one of these points that I'm showing here, this is the plot of orbital eccentricity versus semi-major axis, inclination versus semi-major axis. Every one of the points that I'm going to show you here and in subsequent slides corresponds to what I call an orbit with gold-plated astrometry. These are objects one can trust in the sense that I can forward integrate clones of every one of these objects, clones distributed over the orbital parameter space, over, say, the 3-sigma confidence surface. And in each case, the forward integration tells me the same story. The object, yes, it is in the 5-to-2 resonance, for instance. And everywhere I look over that 3-sigma confidence surface, it gives me the same answer. Okay, so in that sense, these objects have certain orbits. You can see some obvious features here. First thing to note is that the eccentricities and inclinations can be enormous. This is not some flat, narrow ring of material. It's a fat torus in space. Okay, fat both radially in eccentricity space and vertically, as indicated by the inclinations. Okay, so something excited this belt. There are other obvious features. For instance, this finger of points here at about 39 AU, corresponding to the Plutinos, every one of these objects inhabits the 3-2 mean motion resonance with Neptune. Pluto is just one point of about 60. 62, actually, as of yesterday, I checked. But you'd be hard-pressed, I think. The only way to tell whether these other objects inhabit resonances here, I've indicated by these lines the locations of nominal resonance with Neptune. The only way to know for sure is to forward integrate the trajectories of these objects and ask whether the appropriate resonance variables are librating or not. And this is what we do. We do this routinely now, in fact, using the code that Martin Duncan wrote with Hal Leveson, SWIFT. It's straightforward. And we decide whether every one of these objects inhabits a resonance or not. And we test for something like 107 different resonance variables, which, as far as I can tell, is 107 times more resonances than the Minor Planet Center at CFA tests for. So those who understand will appreciate that comment. Okay, so a plot which used to look like this now to us looks like this, in which we can identify these various dynamical classes. The centaurs, by definition, it's a bit of semantics here, right? What you call what? By centaur, we just mean an object which crosses the orbits of one of the giant planets. So these are dynamically short-lived objects. We have the resonant objects, every one of these yellow diamonds.
Gene, how many are new? I mean, in the sense of the last few years?
The rate of discovery now is... Oh, centaurs.
Yeah.
You mean how many new ones are discovered per year?
Yeah.
I would say 7, 8.
So
yeah, 10, 10-ish, 10, 10, 10, 10. Yeah, fairly recent. The discovery rate's just, I mean, it's saturating, I would say, right now at about 100 per year, something like that, of which half of them are from our team. Okay, so
it's
here
all followed up objects you're talking
about. Absolutely gold-plated astrometry here, and it's excruciating to follow these things, month after month, year after year. We keep going after them. Okay, every one of these yellow diamonds is what corresponds to a mean motion resonant object. So here there's Plutinos, but plenty of other resonances are occupied. And I'll discuss these shortly. The scattered belt population, it doesn't matter for now what the difference is between near and extended. Basically, these are colored circles having high eccentricities and also high inclinations, though sometimes not. And finally, the classical belt, which by definition we say an object is classical if its eccentricity is relatively low, say below 0.2. And here are their inclinations, also relatively lower, but they can go all the way up to 15 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the criterion for distinguishing between scattered near and scattered extended?
Okay, so since you ask, I'll just say it. It's based on, for us it's based on the Jacobi constant averaged over time. And it's the Jacobi constant referred to Neptune. So you can guess, the extended ones correspond to Jacobi constant time averaged over the integration greater than 3. And near is less than 3. And 3 is a special number in natural units, right? Because if it's greater than 3, then in the context of the restricted circular three-body problem, which is, I would say, not a bad description for Neptune and a Kuiper belt object, if you're greater than 3, then you can never, ever cross the orbit of Neptune, right, in the restricted circular three-body problem.
Is there anything in motion resonance?
Sorry, you asked about inclination mean motion resonances? Yes. Yes, so we test for these different sub-resonances. And for instance, often in the a few objects, I haven't done a very thorough check, but I do know a few of the objects, suppose it's in the 3-2 E resonance. It is also in the 6-4 I squared. A few objects, okay? So yeah, a few of them do do inhabit both, vibrate in, at the same time in both. Yeah. Okay, so. We check also the cosi to see whether little omega, the argument of perihelion, librates. Our integration, I should say, time for every one of these objects, the ones we do routinely every week, is about 3 million years, which I would say is marginally too short to do a thorough job for the cosi, because the cosi oscillation is something like 10 to the 7 years. So we really need to go longer, but there are a lot of objects, and it's getting harder to do. Okay. Here's the breakdown of the resonant KBOs. So for a while there, for a few years, only the 3 to 2 objects had a lot of press. But it's only because, like I said, the CFA only tests for one resonance. So there are a lot of objects in this particular resonance. But if you test for the other ones, you will find that plenty of other resonances are occupied. 5 to 2, 2 to 1, 9 to 5, 7 to 4, 5 to 3, 3 to 2, 4 to 3, 5 to 4. And yes, we found the first Neptune Trojan as well in the 1 to 1 co-orbit. So many of you perhaps appreciate that many of these resonances are predicted to be occupied in the model of resonant migration. Right, so the story is that Neptune was propelled outwards by planetesimal scattering, and as it plowed its way outwards in the solar system from about 20 AU to about 30 AU, its present-day location at 30 AU, then it swept objects into its mean motion resonances. It captured them, and in so doing, amplified their orbital eccentricities. So I would say it's looking really very good for that model of resonant migration first put forward by Renu Malhotra. It's looking really very good, I would say, for that model. I'm going to discuss these three resonances just to start with, the 5 to 2, the 2 to 1, and the 1 to 1, to try to see what insights these resonances give into the history, the dynamical history of the outer solar system. Yeah?
Were there a probability of capture associated with that model, and is that borne out by the observations?
Okay, so the probabilities of capture are greatest for the first order mean motion resonances. So 2 to 1, 3 to 2, 4 to 3, and 5 to 4, they're the strongest. Though if you look at the simulations, you also find a substantial minority of objects also caught into the 7 to 4 and 5 to 3, I believe. Okay? So if you want to really get into the quantitative details of population ratios between these various resonances, for example, the 3 to 2 and the 2 to 1 are predicted to have equal populations in the standard migration scenario. And you can see here, well, clearly 48, actually the number is more like 62 now, versus 8 just doesn't cut it. It's hard to reconcile with 1 to 1 on the face of it. But there are biases. In particular, the 2 to 1 is further away than the 3 to 2. There were historical biases in what people actually tested for. There are some slight longitudinal biases as well. This is everyone.
Right, okay.
This is everyone.
If you do it with just your data, you know what the biases are.
Right.
What's the story then?
So, well, we haven't taken a careful look at it. I would still say we still find slightly more 3 to 2 objects than 2 to 1. I would say it's closer to something like a 2 to 1 population ratio, something like that. Though again, that's just without debiasing, actually. But if you debiased it, I did a very rough, it's consistent with 1 to 1. It's order of magnitude. I mean, I think it's gonna be okay. The other thing to keep in mind is that the population ratios are also sensitive to initial conditions. So the ones that all these residences which I just highlighted, they all depend upon initially cold belt. And the 5-2, for instance, is predicted not to be populated at all. Okay? So I'm going to discuss that. So that's the other thing to keep in mind, is that it also depends upon initial conditions, what the actual population ratios you expect to be are. But on the whole, if being slightly generous, I would say it's just looking really good for resident migration. Okay, for the 2-1, I want to highlight the 2-1 because it promises to tell you a little bit more about the migration history of Neptune. The 2-1 resonance is special. It's more special than the 3-2 for the following reason. Sorry?
Did you know?
Yeah, sorry. yes, sorry. I'm young. I'm a young person, so I'm just trying to attract attention to myself. Okay. All right. So here's the result of one of our simulations in which we just push Neptune outwards by hand, and it's spiraling outwards over, we just impose the outward migration over a time scale of about 10 to the 7 years, a few times 10 to the 7 years, A over A dot. And then we sprinkle a whole bunch of test particles outside of Neptune's orbit, and we watch as some of those test particles are caught into the 2-1, have their eccentricities amplified, and then we take a snapshot at the end of the migration. So this is a snapshot of all of the 2-1 objects. Okay? Now here's the Sun, here's Neptune. This is a single instant in time. And clearly the pattern is not axisymmetric because the resonance variable is librating, so not all longitudes. There are certain longitudes which are favored, in particular those longitudes which avoid Neptune. And this entire keyhole pattern has a pattern speed equal to the mean motion of Neptune. And what's interesting about the 2-1 is that it exhibits what's called asymmetric libration, something which the 3-2 resonance does not. And what that means is that the resonance variable for the 2-1 can librate about a variety of angles depending upon the eccentricity of the object. In the 3-2 resonance, you can only librate about pi. But for the 2-1 resonance, in fact, any resonance which has an indirect potential contribution to it, you can librate about a variety of angles. So, for instance, this clump of objects here corresponds to objects whose resonance variables are librating about close to 270 degrees in that vicinity, whereas this sideburn corresponds to objects librating about in the vicinity of 90 degrees. Okay? And what's particularly nice about this feature of asymmetric libration is that you can use it to probe the migration history of Neptune. This is a result which we got if A over A dot was a few times 10 to the 7 years, okay, for the migration rate. And you can see the pattern is roughly symmetric about the Sun-Neptune line. If we just speed it up a little bit, factor of 3 to 10. So A over A dot is a few times 10 to the 6 years. And we ask, well, we repeat this experiment, this is what we got. For a faster migration rate, we got this, in which there were three times as many objects caught into the lagging lobe versus the leading lobe. Okay, so this was a bit of a surprise to us. And we wrote it up, and we thought this would be an interesting test. It provides an possibly interesting constraint on the migration history of Neptune, and it's an easy observational test to do, right? All you have to do is point your telescope 70 degrees left of Neptune, count the number of 2-1 objects that you find, and compare it to the number of 2-1 objects that you find forward of Neptune by that same angular displacement. And if there's a difference with this sign, then you will have, I would say it's a smoking gun for Neptune actually having moved outwards in the past at a rate comparable to a few times 10 to the 6 years. Okay, so I only bring this up because I think it's an interesting test of the migration hypothesis, a quantitative one, one which promises to be carried out in the next decade once PanSTARRS comes online. This is a survey which will look at the entire sky once every week. We'll find thousands of slow-moving objects, and we expect that it will find something like 1,000 2-to-1 objects for which we can do this test.
Excuse me, Jim, at the moment it looks like it's going the opposite way.
At the moment it looks like it's going at the opposite way. There's I think one more, possibly two more objects, and they're here. So, I mean, even with this number, I still say it's small number statistics.
No, these objects have similar eccentricity.
Yes, they do. They do.
The white particles, how many of those are in resonance?
They're all in resonance. Simulated particles are all in resonance. They're actually way fewer than objects, simulated particles, right? What I'm doing is shifting and adding. I'm taking snapshots at different instants in time and summing them to create an image like this. Okay. So this was initially a numerical result, but one which we now understand physically and semi-analytically. I won't go into it here. If you want to talk about it afterwards, I'm happy to. What we believe is going on has everything to do with the indirect potential. What you need to understand is the indirect potential and the shift in the resonance libration center when you have outward migration, this same shift that Goldreich talked about when he was talking about the stability of the Galilean satellites in their resonances. It's this shift which gives you a preference for one lobe versus the other. Okay, can be understood on purely adiabatic grounds. So I'm not going to go into this theoretical discussion. I only brought it up because I thought it was an interesting theoretical test, which is applicable not only to the Kuiper Belt, but I would say also to debris disks. In debris disks, if you find non-axisymmetric patterns in your debris disks, this could be a signature for fast migration.
There was a similar bias for Jupiter triplets.
Right.
The trailing ones.
Right. I know you found.
The trailing ones are observed less.
No.
Right, with the opposite sign. But I ask around, and people say the statistics even today are still not good enough. But that's hard to imagine. I mean, there are hundreds of Trojans. So what does it take to put the nail in the coffin? I don't understand. Anything which has an indirect potential will exhibit this asymmetric feature. So it's not just the 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, n-to-1 resonances it's a straightforward extension, I believe. Okay. So that's the story with the 2-to-1 objects. You can see their eccentricities, by the way. They're right here, between 0.25 and 0.4, right here. So I'm going to talk about the Trojan now, the 1-to-1, and just ask you all questions. So here it is, the first discovered Trojan. It's librating back and forth about the forward Lagrange point. Does this once every 10,000 years. We integrated, again, various clones distributed over aerospace, and it just sits there in the resonance for as long as we can integrate. So these are billion-year-long integrations. It's just locked in there. And for that reason, we believe it's a primordial resonant. It's been there since the beginning. We can do some extrapolations. So for instance, we saw this one Neptune Trojan having surveyed something like 60 square degrees in the vicinity of the forward and the backwards Lagrange points. And like every good astronomer, you extrapolate based on your one detection. And we decide that there are something like 20 to 60 Neptune Trojans, depending upon which model you invoke for the eccentricity and inclination distribution for the Trojans. Something like 20 to 60 objects like QR322 in both summing over both the forward and the backwards Lagrange points. Now you can compare this number to the number of Jovian Trojans that are like QR322. That's something like 10. So quite comparable numbers. What is QR322? It's something like, if the albedo is between 12% and 4%, we estimate its diameter between 130 and 230 kilometers. So here's a plot, here's the Trojans. This is real data, Jupiter, the L4 and L5 points. And I show this plot only to try to convince you that the same plot really should be, would be appropriate for Neptune. So the question is, how does this population, for both Neptune and for Jupiter, how do these Trojan populations constrain the circumstances surrounding the formation of the host planet? Okay, so it's often said, particularly in proposals, these Trojans, they're supposed to be the planetesimals which formed their host planet, right? But that luckily they weren't accreted on, and they managed to get caught into the L4 and L5 points. So these are presumably the building blocks of their host planets. Well, how do they get there? And why is it that the Trojan population is so small in mass compared to the theoretical maximum? We could put orders of magnitude more mass at the Trojan points, and they would still preserve their triangular equilibrium configuration. And yet, there's just a little bit of fluff there. So what sets that number? I haven't been able to get a straight answer. How did the Trojans get there in the first place? Well, here's one idea. It invokes adiabatic invariance associated with the growth of the host planet. So if you imagine an object originally in a large amplitude libration horseshoe orbit, here's the host planet. If the host planet grows over a time scale which is long compared to the libration period, then as a consequence of adiabatic invariance, that libration amplitude will shrink. The horseshoe will shrink its way to a tadpole. And the tadpole is what we found. So this is one mechanism by which you can capture Trojans. The shrinking of the libration amplitude has a very weak dependence on the mass of the host planet. The mass of the host planet has to increase by something like, you can see right here, if you put in a factor of 100 here, you'd maybe buy yourself a factor of 3 in the reduction of the libration amplitude. And so to me, this argument tells me that if it's correct, if it's appropriate, these tadpoles were born, they had to have been formed while the host planet was accreting the bulk of its mass, the overwhelming lion's share majority of its mass. A mere factor of 2 won't buy you anything. Okay, and for that reason, I thought it argued against proposals that Neptune's orbital history was quite violent. Because in those proposals, Neptune is more or less fully built, maybe within a factor of 2 or 3 of its present-day mass, and it's supposed to be imparted with a fairly large eccentricity. And I just don't see how, in that scenario, how Trojans can be caught if the orbit was initially quite dynamic. Okay, so I present this as a question. I don't know what the answer is. But they're telling you something about the circumstances under which the host planets were formed. Okay. So that's 2. We have 5 more to go.
Let me ask this question, that Neptune still contains quite a bit of gas, right? Even though it's only 10%.
Well,
presumably it was formed in some kind of gaseous environment. And this argument that you presented about the shrinkage of the libration amplitude is not basically based on a gas-free type of argument, because isn't it true that the L4 and L5 points are the maximum, not the minimum, of these potentials? And if you were to drag on it, things actually drift away, not converge towards the center.
Well, actually, Stan worked it out. Depends on the surface density gradient.
And you think that could create a gap instead of a deep, very complex and
before the gap formation, even during gap formation, there's still going to be a lot of stuff near the co-location that doesn't go away that fast. I mean, you know, and also you're looking at that last bit of accretion process, and I don't know what the time scale is, it's, how does that work out?
Doug, you're just saying that you can't have intelligence.
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, you're saying strip away.
Yeah. You know, this is the same question that people had with regard to the arc of the lecture, right? You know, the question of how do you combine these arcs and you tend to clear the way.
Well, you know, the problem with the arcs is that you needed a resonance. Here you know there's a resonance.
No, but that's the reason you need a resonance to combine, not just radially, but as you use it, is because that any drag or any, you have to have the right kind of resonance, as Sam said. You have to give angular momentum or, you know, at the right,
no, that's the right size. Things. The reason you need a resonance to combine mass immediately is unless there's a resonance, the orbits will shear out. They don't all have the same semi-major axis.
No, but even if you have a resonance, if you give the wrong sign of angular momentum transport, the thing will be viewed. It won't be two words, the P of L4 and L5.
No, I understand. But, this makes it even harder to understand how Neptune.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not posing this a question.
I think the problems are just exacerbated in the case of Neptune because, for the reason that you first pointed out, the gas content being as small as it is. I mean, in the case of Jupiter, people invoke the accretion of the gaseous envelope to explain this factor of 100, I think. Increase in the mass of the planet.
The time scale in the end is we're talking about maybe 1,000 years, the mass doubling time for the end.
So it's not 80 bad.
Okay, it may not be 80 bad.
Oh, wait a minute. For Jupiter, even if it's 1,000, if the mass doubling time is 1,000 years.
But before then, it was still quite fast, okay? Cause it,
for the case of Jupiter, I thought that it was okay to be adiabatic because the libration period for the Trojan was short. It was 100 years, right? But I mean, everything's faster down there, so it's 100 years.
Always being short compared to the mass doubling time.
What's the libration period now?
Libration period now is it's 5 years times the square root of m over m. So square root of m over m is
30.
Is 30. So 30 times 5 is 150. 100 years now.
See, if you started them out in these horseshoes, it's going to be way longer.
Well, it's only the square root of the mass.
Right.
So, okay, maybe a factor of 10.
But what I'm saying is you're much closer. You're larger than the object.
So if you're near the separatrix, so it's going to take longer to go around.
Much longer.
Oh.
Because what you'll work out is only...
Yeah.
L4 and L5.
Well, the difference between a horseshoe, unless you're really close to the separatrix, isn't it true for the initial capture, you have to cross the separatrix.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, it's a question. So far I've discussed 2-to-1. 1-to-1, and I'm going to end this resonant discussion with the 5-to-2, which I mentioned earlier had a problem in the standard migration scenario. It's a third order eccentricity resonance, plenty of objects inside. And the standard migration scenarios failed to explain it. So note first, it's the furthest one out so far. It boasts the highest eccentricities oscillating. They go all the way to 0.45. The inclinations are nothing to sneeze at either, all the way up to 15 degrees. I said it's nothing to sneeze at. So the problem, I think, has to do with the initial conditions. So the standard scenarios you'll find in literature invoke the resonance sweeping over initially cold disk. Okay, so cold, dynamically cold. The eccentricities, for instance, if you had them less than 0.05 and the inclinations less than a few degrees, and you have the 5-to-2 resonance sweeping across it. So here's the panels at time zero. And after a few times 10 to the 7 years, plenty of objects caught into the 2-to-1 resonance, but a lonely one was caught into the 5-to-2. So this kind of population ratio between 5-to-2 and 2-to-1, something like 1-to-100, I mean, even observational bias in the rough estimates that I was making could not account for a factor of 100. And right now, the population ratio is something like 1-to-1. 5-to-2 and 2-to-1, roughly equal numbers. Okay, so it's not observational selection. Yeah?
Now, Horn and I found an interesting phenomenon when we were looking at migrating resonant pairs, that if the eccentricity occurred to the bar initially of the outer planet, you got capture into the higher order resonances. In other words, the capture up with eccentricity instead of down.
Yes. Are you talking about the eccentricity of the particle or of the planet?
Two planets.
Two planets, yeah. Okay. Okay.
And sort of an interesting.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know if anyone's ever looked at that and been able to see a good reason why the capture probability should go up.
Yes. That was the same question I had. I don't know that anybody has looked at it analytically. We looked at, let me show you the next slide. So in further support of what you're saying, we considered higher eccentricities and higher inclinations. So we considered hot initial conditions. We just said, suppose the particle disk had eccentricities ranging all the way up to 0.3 and inclinations ranging all the way up to 8 degrees. Repeat the same experiment where you get plenty better agreement with the observations, plenty better. 5-to-2 and 2-to-1, roughly equal numbers.
And
The behavior of the residences is different with eccentricity. The widths, right? The widths for first order ones, they in the low order theory they go to infinity, but for the high order residences, they actually shrink to zero.
Beautiful shapes.
Okay, so I suspect it has something to do with that. Okay. The level of excitation, so before, it's not just the population ratio, it's also the level of excitation. So here, you managed to jack it all the way up to 0.15, which is still a far cry from the 0.45. And the inclination was hardly touched. But you know that the answer at the back of the book is that it has to be about 10 degrees. So here again, the level of agreement is better, but that's because you started out with a fairly hot disk to begin with. So this begs the question, what I call the third issue, how is the belt preheated? By preheating, I mean heating dynamical excitation prior to resonance capture. So, recently there was a very nice paper written by Rodney Gomez, which addresses this question. He didn't know about the 5-to-2 resonance. He was trying to explain other observations, which also led to this conclusion that the belt had to have been preheated prior to resonance capture. And the idea is very simple. He's just trying to do a better job with the migration. He's trying to do it self-consistently. Rather than pushing Neptune outwards by hand, he's actually going to try to account for the individual interactions between the planetesimals and the planets. So accounting for the masses of the planetesimals. They're not just test particles anymore. They actually have mass. And the idea is very simple. He just wants to scatter off, take the planetesimal and scatter off the planet. And it scatters off into a highly eccentric orbit. That's the preheating. And the second event is resonance capture. So it's a 1-2 punch. So here I try to illustrate it in pictures. Here's the green orbit is the planet. The blue guy is the particle. It comes in close. The planetesimal scatters off of the planet, gets kicked onto a highly eccentric orbit, which then gets, that's the first punch. And then the second punch is the resonance coming in and catching it on its way out. Now there's a problem with this scenario, and that is how to avoid repeated close encounters with the planet. Because once you scatter off of the planet, you tend to, these close encounters change the velocity but not the position. So you tend to come back to the same place that you got kicked. So you keep coming back to the same place that you got kicked, and you keep on getting kicked, and there's a chance that you'll get kicked out of the system entirely. There's a chance that you'll get eaten by the planet. So to avoid this fate, you have to raise your perihelion. You have to get out of that danger zone. So between punches 1 and 2, there has to be a phase 1.5 in which the perihelion is raised. So that's the problem. How do you raise the perihelion? I don't think it's had a very good answer so far. Rodney makes a very good proposal, and that is to use secular resonances, sweeping secular resonances, to decrease the eccentricity and thereby raise the perihelion. So just as the mean motion resonances sweep over the belt, the secular resonances also sweep over the belt. He runs simulations and he finds a tiny fraction of objects which suffer this fate and which can explain the observations. So for a small fraction of the objects, it's fine. I mean, it's fine. Yeah. That's right.
Does that imply that the migration time scale is going to be very short? Or is there an implication there? Because if you got to do it during the depletion process to utilize the sweeping secular resonance, now the migration occurs on a few times in 6 years.
Well, what's depleting the disk?
Well, you also use sweeping secular resonance.
But not from gas motion.
From the gas
motion. Yeah, actually, that's an important point. So in Rodney's simulations, he's not using gas. He's accounting for the shifts in the locations of the secular resonances due to the shifts in the locations of the orbits of the planets. So it's not a completely self-consistent calculation. Not because he's not including gas, but because he's not including the changes in the locations of the secular resonances due to the self-gravity of the particle disk. In that sense, it is not self-consistent.
So he's capturing things in the resonance that have got close to the planet. But that means that there's some stuff outside, which has never gotten yet close to the planet, which could also get captured in the resonance, just a classic picture, right? In other words, there's some cold population sitting outside. Which does pass through the resonance, and which presumably some of those will get caught.
You mean the secular resonance?
No,
the 5 to 2.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, they wouldn't get caught in the 5 to 2, no, they'd get caught in the other ones.
You mean?
It's a continual process.
No, I understand. I'm just saying that.
You mean even exterior to the 5 to 2, like 3 to 1, 4 to 1, 5 to 1?
Same things that never got scattered, but got captured in the resonance before they got close enough to scatter off the planet. So in other words, there should be a population, a primordial cold population. I mean, you're arguing
that would much more favor. That would much more favor the lower order.
Yes.
Ones.
Yeah.
Whose eccentricities remain primordially small.
So he had to heat up guys that never got close to the planet.
Right. But he everybody.
Exactly. And this only heats guys that were once close to the planet.
Right.
So that's sort of bothersome because 92
you need a close encounter.
Right? What I'm saying is
there must be some cold.
Observationally there wasn't any cold disk.
Absolutely. That's right. Well, that's issue 4. Yeah.
So this heating mechanism doesn't explain why everybody else who never crossed Neptune's orbit got heated.
You can get heated without having constant encounters.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's still very narrow in phase space.
Well.
Right. It's not everywhere. I mean, what his point is that you got to heat everybody.
Yeah.
Or the alternate view is there was never anybody out there. Yes. Only people close to Neptune. Maybe that's the way to go.
Or near resonance.
Well,
see what I'm talking about?
Well, not completely, because
what I'm saying is These guys here, you had to have, at one point, they had the same semi-major axis, essentially, as Neptune.
Right, so well, okay. We're orbit crossing. You were orbit crossing.
You got to be within a hill radius.
Right? Yeah.
Okay. So that's close. What about guys that were, but the mean motion resonance is way far out compared to the hill radius. Okay. So there's a whole population supposedly out there, which is cold, which never gets close to Neptune crossing, but which experiences this resonance sweeping the
mean motion
going across.
Yes.
And therefore, in things like the 2-to-1, or 3-to-2, I should say, should have gotten captured. Okay. And they ought to act like, so dynamically they're going to look differently than this preheated version of things. So there ought to be a population in the resonance currently which mimics the cold captured particles.
They're in the first order resonances. Yes. They're in things like the 3-to-2 and the 2-to-1.
So do you think that's consistent still with there being a cold population?
I think yes. Yes,
because the
capture probabilities go down with increasing eccentricity for those first order resonances.
So the question though, I would have thought that the population of original cold guys was way higher than this hot population, and therefore you'd still have this problem that you'd have too many guys in the lower order mean motion, first order mean motion resonances versus these higher order resonances.
I think one can cook up an initial eccentricity distribution prior to resonance capture by any resonance that can explain the present day population ratio. You'd have to have a population of cold objects and a population of hot ones.
Well, but this population of hot ones, well, okay.
Cold and preheated, both,
yeah,
both.
But that was my point, but you did need some preheating, not just from this mechanism, I would have thought.
It's too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the bulldozers came to pushing these things out. As I understood, like, see if I can remember, we did a paper at PBS where
it's out now.
They pass through resonances or carbon resonances as Neptune moves out. But Neptune's migration is stochastic.
Yeah.
Because of the individual encounters. And therefore, they get out of resonance and they'd be left behind. And that sort of provides a means for giving them more energy and beating them up. Yet they're not in the resonance at present time.
Yes.
Story about
this. Yes.
Stuff that didn't get captured, but which, because there's a probability associated with it.
Temporarily.
The Neptune stops at the edge of the Kuiper belt. The Kuiper belt is completely truncated. There was nothing beyond 38, somewhere around 38. Everything started closer in. Migration out, some of the trapping occurred, some of the things dropped out. Because then you have to explain why there is cold, why there's a cold population. It's turning it upside down. Why is there a cold population?
Yeah.
Out at 40 to 45.
Right.
Is the truncation still?
So that's the next slide. Maybe before I. Well, let me just mention these two facts, just to provide more context. So there's other lines of evidence for preheating. For instance, the scattered belt populations, in particular the extended scattered belt population, this guy, which we found and Gladman popularized. Large inclination, extremely large eccentricity. But what's remarkable is that the Jacobi constant is enormous. It's like 4. In its present day orbit, it could never have crossed Neptune in the past. Okay, so something had to have kicked it onto a large eccentricity and raised its perihelion to its current value of 42 AU, which is miles away from 30, which is Neptune. So that's one line of evidence, this extended scattered belt. And another line of evidence is the inclination distributions of the individual families. So, for example, the Plutinos, a good fit can be had by this inclination distribution. These various plots, they're just done in different coordinate systems. This is dNdi, this top panel, dNdi, the differential number of objects per inclination bin for the Plutinos, this curve right here, okay, versus inclination. You can see there are plenty of objects at 15, 20 degrees, 25 degrees. But if you look at the simulations in which the 2-to-1 objects are caught from initially cold population, the inclinations never get above 5 degrees. can never get 25 degrees. His inclination resonance is just second order and weak.
So it's probably the same thing.
Same thing. Yeah. So I just wanted to present some other lines. It's not just the 5-2, the other lines of evidence as well. So let me jump now to this cliff, which everyone has already talked about, which is the fact, the startling observation that, well, there's nothing outside 50 AU, actually 48. Nothing that is with an eccentricity less than 0.2. There are plenty of objects out there, but they're all highly eccentric.
Or you could say, instead, talk about the periastral distance, perihelion distance, and say nothing less than peri.
Yeah, these are lines of constant peri distance, yes. So this one is 40, 45, so yes. this one's probably, well, this one's the closest one we have, so
it's more
50, 48, yeah. Maximum peri of 48. Okay, well, there's a cliff of what I call a cliff, Kuiper cliff of objects, nothing outside 48 AU. This was first reported back in 98, very tentatively, by David Jewett. And more observers have put in more and more time to find objects outside of this distance, and zero. Okay. Nothing. Not even one object. I did some rough statistical estimates, and it looks pretty good at about 4 or 5 sigma. It's looking pretty good. That there really is nothing at 40, 50, 60 AU.
Anything big.
Anything big. Right. Anything big. Okay. Well.
Anything bright.
Okay. Anything bright. Spoken like a true observer. So people have already mentioned this work published just recently in Nature, Leveson and Morbidelli. The fact is, this edge, it's not at 50, it's at 48, which, coincidentally or not, corresponds to the 2-to-1 resonance, the strongest first order outermost Lindblad resonance. So Hal says, no coincidence. It's because the edge is there now because it was combed outwards by the 2-to-1 resonance, in the sense that the 2-to-1 resonance caught an object. You have to invoke a primordial edge inside the 2-to-1, right? So you still have an edge problem. It's just that you've pushed it inside now. Okay. Then the 2-to-1 resonance comes along, captures objects, and then pushes them along. And then it has to let go as it keeps going forwards. And how does it let go? Well, that's explained by invoking some stochastic component, some jittery component to the migrating resonance. Okay, because the migration is occurring because of planetesimal scatterings, there's got to be some noise level. And they tune the noise level so that they get the right retainment efficiency. Okay, you still have a.
Bodies that they have to put in to get that sort of noise?
I forget the answer. I think they put in, they said moons.
Yeah.
Something, lunar moons.
Lunar-sized.
Like,
lunar-sized.
Okay, yeah.
Is that reasonable?
And then they. And,
lunar-sized.
But then you have to get rid of them. Well, where are they?
Yeah. Lots of big guys.
Where are they, you know? Where are they now?
Those close encounters will do that, of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's at least one.
Oh, Triton. Well, Hawaii's out there in the belt.
Because it ran into a satellite on a close encounter.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's either that or gas drag. It got captured
somehow. Yeah.
Okay, you still have a problem. You still have to explain why there was a primordial edge, right, inside the present-day location. I'm sure there are plenty of proposals that you could make. Andrew Uden made one involving radial drift, aerodynamic drift of solids. Right? This is well known to everyone. The planetesimal moves at a faster rate than the pressure-supported gas, so it experiences friction, and then it drags its way in, it accretes its way relative to the gas. And it's simple to see that this disk of solids will shrink its way in. And there may be a threshold for the metallicity in forming planetesimals. You have to achieve some threshold supersolar metallicity before gravitational instability can form planetesimals.
How about an event in the cluster of the sun?
I believe that's also been proposed. So another star coming by and tidally stripping the outer rim.
What's the radius of the propylids?
The radius of the propylids? Well, photospheres, I think, are something like 100. Something like that. Something like that, right?
We see plenty of big disks.
Propylids are sort of
teardrop-shaped. So the critical radius basically is totally evaporated. Association velocities of 2 kilometers, less than 10 kilometers. And at 48, let's just say 49, if 30 divided by 7, so it's 4 kilometers per second. Okay, so that's more or less close to the critical radius for launching a fully evaporated wind. And grains gets carried.
As far as the scattering event goes for the star, the encounter, I mean, I did a little estimate for the probability of such an encounter. I got something like 10 to the minus 4, maybe a few times that. Exactly. For a stellar density of something like 1,000 solar mass, maybe 10 to the 4 solar masses per cubic parsec. So, it's not a very large probability. Sorry?
You're staring up as well, you know?
Yeah, well, that's, people love it for that reason.
It's not just venting into the interior region. It turns out the equivalent of COSA does apply in this solar cluster problem. And the reason for that is because even though there's typical distant encounter of a field star, the secular effect can build up. Mm-hmm. You can clear away a large region, I mean, without getting close to it.
Right.
And the reason, I mean, it's for the same reason. You're building up a libration, you know, because you're during this encounter. And it's fairly well known in stellar, it's a stellar cluster binary interaction and a lot of things like that.
But you want to worry, right? Because I read a paper once which pointed out that the COSI oscillation would not be appropriate because any precession frequency which another star induces on the planet will be small compared to the precession frequencies induced by the planets amongst themselves.
No, this is tested now, you know, with lots of embodied calculation. And it also goes back, if you look at, of course, the classic paper of Peggy 75, it's already in there to some extent. You can calculate both the energy and the angular momentum exchange and look at the critical damage radius all the way down. Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite significant.
It's much easier to excite eccentricity
That's right. But then once you start to excite eccentricity, yeah, they start to cross the orbit of Neptune and you start to get into trouble. Okay, but I mean, you still have other things there. Okay, it's not by isolation.
And that's fundamental, what we expect. Because if you just have, say, one planet,
then it won't make a difference.
But it's a mutual.
So are you saying that the star doesn't have to come as close as, say, two times?
We have lots of distant encounters.
Distant encounters.
And the effect.
Oh,
all right,
okay.
By what fraction?
Interesting.
By how much?
Well,
increase that?
I have an estimate here, but you know, we were looking primarily at the young clusters and also for global clusters.
The ecliptic.
So. Again, is there a bias for that color?
Bias.
Is it the skew color inclination correlation?
Yeah.
Spend most of your time there. Bias.
Yeah. Sure.
You're saying that there's no correlation in plots that have the last few.
That's correct.
So what relevance is the last bar?
I'm not sure if it really matters that there's, and that just reduces the number of points that you would get at high inclination, right? That just means in all colors, yeah.
But you have so few points there that you can see.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you have it. You can believe it if you want it. And if you do believe it, you're going to have to explain it. There is actually a little bit more evidence that there is a bimodal distribution in inclinations. So here, you know, it looks, you wouldn't see that. Maybe you might say there's a little bit of clumping, but that you could ascribe that to the bias, which Stan has mentioned. The difference is just because Trujillo and Brown had their own points, their own data, and these are literature values. It's just for their paper. Brown claims that if you de-bias the inclination distribution, that the classical belt actually has two populations, a thin disk and a thick disk. So I showed you before, I highlighted the Plutino population. There's just one population, a fat one. But for the classical disk, he says it's thin, and there's a thick disk population. And that's with the debiasing now. OK. I won't bother with this. And finally, the last issue is, this is the issue which Morbidelli said at the end at his talk. He was also there in Chile. He said, this is the problem that drives me absolutely crazy. I mean, if you know Morbidelli, you could hear him saying that. Drives me absolutely crazy. And it drives me crazy too. The idea, the consensus in the field is that there had to have been about 10 Earth masses worth of solids in the beginning. OK, and why do we need 10 Earth masses worth of solids? Well, it's because we need to form objects as large as Pluto. And we also need to form binaries. So the standard parameters which Goldreich et al. Use to form binaries, they need 100 to 1,000 times more material than is presently there.
A certain amount of mass in order to affect the migration.
Oh, yes. So the best estimate for that, Hahn and Malhotra, they said they needed about 50 Earth masses, if I recall. 50 Earth masses worth of material sprinkled throughout the outer solar system between, 5 and 30 AU to affect the migration.
What about the gas as far as migration?
Well, this is where his test can determined, right? Because if it's a gas, then it's within a few million years. If it's invisible, it's much longer, and that's where it's headed.
But that doesn't help this problem.
No, this problem drives me crazy. 10 Earth masses, and today we estimate 0.1 Earth masses. And let me just say, so obviously in two orders of magnitude that you have to explain, where did it all go?
And that you wouldn't be happy for it to be scattered out and what during this process.
Well, I don't know. I think that needs to be taken a closer look at.
It could be ground to dust and go away.
No, it can't.
No, it's not enough.
Because that would be not a luminosity.
Yeah. No, not today, but
even then.
Yeah, that's just a factor of 3.
And
And had it been the case, I mean, it would have taken a lot of time. You know, the sun would have been the most, the cross section would be too small.
I mean, what's really odd, right, is that the collisional, one way to say it is that the collisional time, the Kuiper belt today is collisionless. It's collisionless by two orders of magnitude in the following sense. It takes 100 Hubble times for a, you know, 30 kilometer size object to impact a 100 kilometer size object, something like that. And if you had to guess what the collision time would be for, you would guess a billion years, right? You would guess the age of the solar system. You would guess that it has evolved to the point so that when you're looking at it, the collision time would be comparable to the age of the system. Instead, it's 100 times longer than what I would have guessed.
For Jupiter, for example, which is one example, is much larger.
Neptune as well. But you have to cross Jupiter. So there is a difference between 40 AU and 5.
So in order for us to get all of the comets, you know, there is some argument that comets tells you that there may be about 100 Earth masses, reservoirs, way, way, way up. The Oort cloud.
Oort cloud. 2 to 50, right? No, there's a big uncertainty.
More like
1 to 50.
But I mean, that's where your head lies, right in between 2 to 50.
Well, yeah, but the efficiency of getting into the Oort cloud is actually pretty bad these days in our simulations. So it's even worse. You've ejected much more than. So you eject, probably forming the Oort cloud, you must have ejected at least an order of magnitude more than is in the Oort cloud now.
Okay.
Yeah, but none of this really helps him, right? Because he's worried about guys that are out beyond Neptune. They have 10 Earth masses out beyond Neptune. Okay. And so you said you got to take guys that are out at 40 on circular orbits, or 48 on circular orbits.
Right.
And you got
to get rid of them.
You got to get rid of them. And it's not so trivial. You got to somehow sign them so they start crossing the orbit of Neptune. And then you can toss them out in the Oort cloud or whatever. But they're a long ways away. So how do you excite them?
Yeah. But if you take the model that everything was much more compact, then perhaps that's the
way. Well, that's the way out. So there was never 10 Earth masses out of 48 either. There was 10 Earth masses close in, you know, Pluto and everything else were formed binaries.
Then
you
move them all out. Pushed out. Yeah. I don't know.
It seems, it's a two order of magnitude problem, though. I mean, you're not going to buy much by going halving your radius.
No. The idea then is that everything's already essentially crossing the orbit of Neptune. Right? In other words, there was never a cold belt out of 40 AU. You're closing in.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, I see. You're right. Right. Yeah, this is another ingredient in Hal's story,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's actually another part to that story. Again, if we can go to fewer people here or more people here to talk about it, but they've had a real problem. Yeah, I know. But if the planet, if Neptune gets out to that point, they've been doing simulations where it's very hard to stop it at 30 AU if you
have
10 or 20
right.
masses beyond as well. Why did it stop at 30 AU? Why didn't it keep going?
Why didn't it keep going?
So add that to your list.
I see.
So it's natural to stop it if there's nothing there.
There was nothing there.
And then you can form all this, you can have 100 Earth masses or 50 Earth masses of stuff interior. Do all the scattering, form Pluto, scatter everybody out to distances, kick out a lot of material. I don't know. I mean, it's just a possibility. But then why was the solar system so compact?
Okay, well, you know, 5 problems is better than 7, so. you know, one thought I had was this estimate of the mass, you get it by counting. You just count objects. But I've been trying to brainstorm ways to get at it from a completely different direction, dynamically. So yeah, how would you really weigh the Kuiper belt? Well, here's one way. I actually have my doubts about how practicable this is, but I think it works in principle. What if you were to measure the Laplacian plane in the Kuiper belt? You can predict where the Laplacian plane should be just based on the existence of the 4 giant planets. And if you can measure, so you'd get some prediction for what the symmetry plane of the belt would be. Then you go out with your observer friends and you find where the plane is. You can actually just look on the sky and see where they are on the sky and then draw a symmetry plane. And so you'd have an observational determination of the Laplacian plane. And if there was any difference between the two, then it could be attributed to the mass of the belt itself. You could measure it that way. Yeah, see that's the rub. So
paper where they have done that.
Really?
Yeah. They've tried to determine the Laplacian plane and shown that all the deep surveys have been looking at the wrong place.
Well, not by much.
Not by much,
but yeah, okay. Yeah.
Dang.
Okay.
Simon.
The upper limits, I think the best upper limit's not from spacecraft. The best upper limit, I think, is from Comet Halley. And that upper limit is 1.6. Earth masses, four ring of material at 50 AU. So,
that only buys you one ring.
Yeah.
And this is like albedo.
This one?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's partly what motivates dynamical. Yeah, this whole.
But
yeah.
If you believe the Halley limit.
Yeah.
You still have this problem.
Oh no, absolutely. I just would like to know how much mass there is. That's all.
Yeah.
I like to know, rather than counting. And because this is afflicted not only by the albedo, that's a worry, but I would say an even greater worry is the size distribution of the material, because you don't know where most of the mass is sitting, which decade.
There is another point, too, that if you start with population bodies on Neptune crossing orbits and you wait 4 billion years, about 1% of the objects is left. Sort of an interesting factor.
Oh, you mean...
The simulations have led us to an idea where we were actually looking for things coming from the carbon bubble. But we picked up objects that were encountering Neptune at T equals zero and followed that population for 4 billion years. And because of the resonance captures, the capture near the resonances, the scattered disk persists at about the 1% of the population's left of the integration.
I see.
Otherwise, it would have been lower.
It would have been much lower if it had not been for an issue of getting trapped near resonances and having the period lifted away from Neptune. A naive calculation would have taken 2 foot things on Neptune crossing orbits after, you know, at 10 to 8 years or something, everything would be gone. But what happens is that they get trapped near, they get scattered and land very near high-level resonances, which lifts the perihelion out for a while. They're in metastable orbits and then they come back in again later. The numerical result is if you do this calculation for 4 billion years, at 1% of the population.
There's your two order name.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
No, but the scattered disk versus the other particles is sort of roughly equal masses or not?
Yeah, but the observations are that there's roughly equal mass in the scattered disk versus the classical case.
Right, so
the scattered disk is more unstable, so it's probably the source of the...
No, but it doesn't help this complicated, right? Because
so
not everybody started...
That's true. Before. That's true. It doesn't help, but it does help if you believe that everything got there like by scattering disks.
Okay.
Even if the cold population in the Levison and Morbidelli paper, it comes from material that's been pushed out.
Wow.
Scattered stuff.
Okay, that's it. So.